Mommy said it's our secret.
Who will believe me? I'm just a kid.
If I'm good and behave myself, everything will be okay.
Daddy works so hard, we have to help him by being good.
If my friends found out, I would die of embarrassment.
A child in an abusive household can feel helpless and without a voice. Learn to notice the signs and speak for them.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, and our co-host, Lila Jones, President of Imagine Publicity, who is with me in South Carolina. So good evening, everyone, and I welcome you to another episode each and every Saturday evening from 5 to 6 Eastern Time. And I just wanted to say good evening, Delilah, and welcome. Thank you very much for being here each and every week with me. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Donna, and I hope your listeners noticed the PSA that we played at the beginning of the show rather than the music this week. This is something that was done by a friend and colleague of mine, Amy Robinson, who's a voiceover actress. Her sister, Nikki Lilley, was murdered. The only suspect in the case is the husband. He's still out there. Has never been charged, but anyway, she took this project upon herself this year for Domestic Violence Awareness Month in October, and she was so surprised that so many of her colleagues stood up to join her in the project, so she created a series of PSAs to bring awareness to the problem in different areas. They're all addressing a different area of violence in the home. So if we get a chance and if we remember throughout the show, you may hear some more.
Okay, very good. And yeah, I just wanted to give a plug for National Domestic Violence or Intimate Partner Homicide, as Susan Murphy Milano used to say, Awareness Month. And your company, our associates, are doing a multitude of really stellar activities. And just wanted to mention very briefly that her ultimate prevention tool, the evidentiary abuse affidavit, via document the abuse, is now available to a brand new reformatted website, and it's just wonderful. It's very sleek, it's very easy to follow, it's very impressive. So I recommend everyone please go to documenttheabuse.com and go to our websites and take a look at what's there. And in view of that, we have another type of abuse that we are talking about this evening, and it's a topic that very few people talk about. We haven't had it featured on our show, and we're very happy to have a very impressive guest who I met at the Melanie Eileen Leger Conference in the spring. And our guest is Christopher Anderson, and he is the executive director of MaleSurvivor.org, which is my understanding their outreach is international with respect to helping male survivors of sexual assault abuse. And so we have a multitude of information to learn this evening, and we're very happy to have Chris as our guest. So welcome, Chris. Welcome to Shattered Lives. Thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Donna. It's a great pleasure to join you and Delilah both.
Well, great. We're happy to try to, I guess you could say, tackle this topic. And I know it's just going to virtually scratch the surface, because there's so much information that you have and your website has. But what we like to do with our show and dealing with the aftermath of crime, it's always very helpful for our audience for us to be able to paint a picture and tell a story. And I know that you personally have been a survivor of abuse, and maybe that's a good way to start with our audience in terms of introducing this topic this evening, and then we can get into some other things if you don't mind.
Sure, I'm always happy to talk about my own story for a number of reasons, but really the most important, I very strongly feel that whenever any survivor of sexual abuse is able to share their story, I feel that the experience of speaking our truth and speaking our story is a part of the healing process. And every time a survivor is able to share their story with me, I always try to share with them that I think whenever we're able to speak our truth, a little bit of the shame that we carry on ourselves, that was created by the abuse, flakes away, and it helps us see a little bit more of the truth of who we are. So I think that's a really important part of...
Very therapeutic, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I am, and I don't know how familiar you or your audience is with ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, but I like to
very
share
much
with
so.
People.
We're very much familiar with that by a friend of ours, yes. So thank you for asking.
Great. So I have an ACEs score of, depending on how, which of the sort of measures that people use, either a 5 or a 7. I grew up in a house where both of my parents were significantly emotionally challenged. They had a number of issues that they dealt with, which of course meant that I have a lot of issues that I had to deal with when I was growing up. I remember when I was 2 years old, a toddler, one of my first memories in life was I was having a temper tantrum in the kitchen of my house, and I remember my mother out tantruming me. That kind of sort of set the stage for me for most of, I just kind of knew at that point that I was on my own. And I was an only child, well, I am an only child, I should also mention.
Okay.
So I grew up in somewhat difficult circumstances. My mother was also a hoarder, among sort of other issues. My parents were not obviously the most emotionally supportive or connected people. So I really did grow up in an environment where there was a tremendous amount of emotional neglect, but not necessarily overt abuse on their part. And that's kind of an important piece of the puzzle to try and to mention as well.
Okay.
But I kind of grew up without, and I don't ever remember either of my parents telling me that they loved me when I was a little kid. I don't remember being held. I don't remember really any kind of positive nurturing experiences with, in the house that I grew up in. And most of the things I remember are my parents screaming at each other when they were, when they happened to be in the same room. So that's kind of the environment that I was raised in. When I got to school, it was really one of the first environments where anybody paid attention to me, and I got any kind of positive feedback at all. And I wasn't prepared emotionally or socially for those kind of interactions. And anytime somebody said something, wrong or like took a toy away from me or disagreed with me, I tended to explode. And as you can imagine, in kindergarten or preschool, that's something that kind of tends to happen quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to the point where I was actually put into group therapy when I was 5 at the county mental
Chris,
hospital.
Can I ask, how did you deal with any kind of positive reinforcement? I mean, you didn't have that either. So
I don't,
how did you?
I don't remember there ever being any positive reinforcement.
Even in school?
Even in school, I got to say, actually, I mean, I'm sure there was, but I was so kind of on high alert for negative experiences and sort of already walking into a situation feeling so traumatized that any kind of positive experiences I had were, I don't remember, and it didn't register for me at the time.
Okay.
So fast forward through a lot of stuff, and we'll get to when I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was obviously sort of given that background. I'm sure you can imagine I wasn't exactly the most popular kid. Mm-hmm. In my neighborhood, I was kind of the social outcast. I was the kid everybody picked on because I was the vulnerable one. I really didn't know how to interact with any of the other kids my age. And there was a man who moved into my neighborhood right about the time I was 8 or 9 years old, and I wound up first befriending his son. And he came up to me very soon afterwards, and we struck up a friendship. And it was one of the first times in my life that I felt that an adult was paying attention to me and was caring about me. And I felt, for whatever reason, this was somebody who made me feel good. And I remember that I would go over to his house after I got out of school. It felt like a safe place. I always remember he had pink lemonade in the refrigerator, and that was something that I thought was really great. And eventually we wound up, we always also talked about wrestling. I'm 39 years old, and when the sexual abuse occurred, this was back in the 80s, and the WWF was a big thing, and Hulk Hogan and WrestleMania was something that everybody used to talk about, in school, and we would watch that, and that was kind of a big deal. And I remember the way the abuse began. I went over to his house one day, and he asked me if I wanted to wrestle with his son, WWF style. And I didn't really know what he meant. And he said, well, WWF style in your underwear. And I felt a little funny about it. But, his son seemed to be okay with it. And I kind of went along with it. And I remember that time, I don't remember him specifically touching me at that point in time, but I vaguely remember him taking pictures of the two of us, of me and his son, sort of wrestling in our underwear. And then there was another time shortly thereafter when I went over to the house after school and the son wasn't there. I should say this was a single father. I don't remember ever seeing a mother around, and I don't really know what the circumstances were of that family. I'm assuming, sort of looking back on the memories and trying to piece certain things together, that he was a single father who shared custody, and sometimes the children were around, sometimes they weren't. So I went over one day after school, shortly after the initial wrestling incident, and he asked me if I wanted to wrestle with him, again, WWF style. Mm-hmm. And I knew in my heart of hearts that something was really wrong, and I just felt something in my stomach just turn, but I didn't know how to say no.
You were scared, and
terrified. And again, this was, I was about 8 or 9 years old at the time. And, I won't go into too many graphic details, but, I remember going into his bedroom. I remember being on the bed. I remember him on top of me. And I remember at one point turning my head to the right and zoning out. I remember the air conditioner in the window. And I basically dissociated, kind of left the room paying attention to the air conditioner and the sound of the air conditioner. And I sort of have snippets of memories of things that were being done to me at that time. again, I'm, you know, I don't, won't go into it, but we'll just say that obviously
that, that was the initial experience that you had with this man, right?
Well, it wasn't the initial experience I had with that with this man. It was the initial sexual abuse that I experienced with him directly.
That's what I meant to say. Yes.
Correct.
And then it proceeded for a long period of time.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. I remember very clearly those two incidents. I can also bring you to the house where it occurred. I could show you the room where it happened. And it's entirely possible that if I heard the sound of that air conditioner, I could probably pick it out just by sound.
Wow.
But I don't remember his name. And in point of fact, there's a number of details from the ages of 8 to about 12 years old that are still very fuzzy for me in my life. And as I've done more and more work around the issue of sort of my own personal healing, but I've gotten to know other survivors of sexual abuse in childhood, the experience of dissociation and sort of the fuzzy memory issues are not an uncommon thing that you hear spoken of by a lot of survivors.
Yeah, isn't it kind of a mechanism of survival at the time?
Exactly, very much so. It's a mechanism of self-preservation.
Right. Mm-hmm. So where does that, after that, where does that bring you with respect to what you're doing in your life, how you're feeling about things? Do you want to associate with these people after the initial sexual experience?
Sure.
Do you still continue to interact with them?
excuse me. You know, it's interesting. I don't recall specifically how the abuse ended. I know that at some point in time I stopped going over to that house and stopped spending time with him. And at some point in time I know that they left the neighborhood, so I assume they moved somewhere else. Throughout the rest of that, the rest of my childhood, as I was living in that neighborhood, there were a number of other sort of strange things that happened, sort of disconnected from that experience. There was at one point in time, there was one of the kids in the neighborhood found a stash of pornography that some other person had kept in their basement, and I remember that they. Because my parents were sort of, you know, not around, then my house was considered kind of a safe house. I remember that they were, you know, some of the older kids in the neighborhood brought that stash over to my house and sort of bullied me into holding on to it in my sort of room.
If your mom was a hoarder, then you probably couldn't even, you know, maybe locate it or whatnot, or it could be buried under something, right?
Yeah. Oh, it was a perfect place for them to store it because there was no way that anybody knew, you know. So, and
that's,
I remember, like, they would come over to my, to my house, you know, randomly and, you know, would, you know, basically go through it and look at it. And it was all very just, you know, weird situation. And that's kind of just, one example of a number of things that happened, you know, throughout the course of those years.
Yeah.
So as I continued growing up and I got into high school, I basically, as is true with a number of sexual assault and other, you know, people who have, you know, pretty high ACE scores, I didn't really have a lot of great social skills, and it was very difficult for me to trust other people. I didn't have a lot of friends. I had some as I was growing up, but I kind of got through high school and got to college and got into, you know, into early adulthood. You know, basically the whole time, more or less, feeling like I just needed to get through it. I just needed to get by. I was struggling with significant anxiety and depression. It was very difficult for me to connect to other people socially and emotionally. And I didn't necessarily remember, you know, all of the things that I had gone through as a kid. I just kind of tried to put as much of it behind me as I could. but I was living constantly with the emotional burden of having gone through all of those experiences. And
we can manifest with physical illnesses. Our friend who dealt with a very dysfunctional childhood, she had physical chronic illnesses now that are very serious. So I'm just wondering that as you're talking.
I've not really had many physical illnesses or issues sort of along those lines. The bulk of the challenges that I have faced really have been significant emotional and mental challenges surrounded by, you know, being able to connect or feel safe, you know, in my own, you know, in my own circumstances, in my own life. And really the biggest challenge is being, you know, I felt, you know, I've had a number of periods in my life. The first time when I was 13 years old, all the way up till when I was 30 years old, struggling on and off with major depression and oftentimes suicidal ideations.
Mm-hmm. And you're 39 now with regard to, and you're kind of burying this in your psyche all the time, just kind of not dealing with it. Can you tell us about sort of, was there like a day of reckoning or, you know, or was your initial association with male survivor, was that the aha light bulb moment for you and your activities with them, or how did that aspect play out?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so glad you asked me about that and about how I came to male survivor. It's interesting. I spent most of my early adulthood living. I never forgot the experience of being sexually abused as a kid, but within the context of all of the other chaos and dysfunction that I grew up in, the sexual abuse just didn't seem like it was that big a deal. And I kind of spent a lot of my life in and out of therapy, but I never dealt with the sexual abuse at all. I should also say that, you know, my father died when I was 19 years old. My mother passed away when I was 26. And, you know, the circumstances of both of those, you know, things happening were also sort of difficult to process and somewhat traumatic and kind of cast a shadow over, you know, most of my, you know, 20s. You know, so I kind of got to 30, and I never really had dealt with the sexual abuse, and I never thought it was that big a deal. Mm-hmm. And I'd been married for a couple of years by that point in time, and my ex-wife and I...
Had you been in therapy?
I'm sorry?
Had you been in therapy at this point?
Yes. Yeah, for many of the other issues, for struggling and dealing with a lot of the dysfunction in my home and things of that nature, but never around the sexual abuse. I had been married for a couple of years, and my ex-wife and I were not very emotionally connected. As a matter of fact, I think one of the things that was very sort of stereotypical about our relationship was that we both kind of went into it thinking that this was a good partnership because neither of us wanted very much from one another. I can say that the number of times that we actually had sex was really, you know, over the course of the entire time that we knew each other, you know, maybe we did it once every couple of months, if that. And that was part
of... How long were you married?
We were married for about 3 years, and we knew each other for about 5 years.
Okay.
And, you know, part of what I think made us think that this would work was because we didn't ask for very much from one another, either physically or emotionally, in terms of the relationship. I don't at all want to come across as being, you know, disrespectful. There's no hard feelings. And I haven't been in touch with her for, you know, a number of years now. So I don't want to in any way have people sort of walk away from this part of the conversation thinking that she's a bad person. It's just, that's a, you know, kind of reflection of who I was.
Yeah, is that very typical, Chris, with regard to your colleagues at Male Survivor? Is that pretty much the pattern people may marry after an experience like this, looking for companionship, looking for some type of non-physical intimacy, or if that's, I don't know if that's the right term, or just looking to fulfill some other kinds of needs? Is it pretty common?
It's, I would hesitate to say that it's very common, only because I feel very strongly that every survivor is unique and we all make different choices. However, I will say I think it's very, I do think it is typical for many survivors of sexual assault to try and come to some kind of balance with a need to not be alone, but also struggling with the challenges of being trusting and being intimate emotionally and physically with a partner. So I think many survivors face significant challenges around sharing, you know, all different kinds of intimacy. And certainly there are a number of other male survivors that I've spoken with over the course of my career who shared with me very similar experiences in their marriages or past relationships.
Right. Well, when you were in therapy, did this not come up, or did you feel you still didn't feel as if you felt comfortable enough to bring this up as a topic?
You know, the things that I felt like I was dealing with in therapy until I started dealing with the sexual abuse really were more along the lines of feeling broken and feeling flawed as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to get to a place where I could hold on to some sense of pride, some sense of I was okay and that I deserved to be appreciated.
A whole person?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know,
excuse me.
Go ahead, Delilah.
I just wanted to ask Christopher, I'm talking about the therapy that you received. Mm-hmm. Did you find that within your therapy, or maybe later afterwards, that there were a lot of I think there's an issue surrounding, you know, repressed memory and how it affects people in adulthood. What was your experience with that?
Well, fortunately, I did not run into any therapists who ever tried to, you know, push me to, you know, dredge up unrecalled memories or who are very strong sort of, you know, in that along those lines. There's certainly a number of therapists who feel it's very important to help survivors re-experience previous traumas or try and mine, you know, unrecollected memories. I personally tend to feel that, you know, that's not a... If it's forced upon a survivor, it's very likely that it won't be an effective treatment. And we can talk more about this when we get into
more harm than good. Then with regard to that, it's kind of like sleeping dog's life.
Not necessarily. I think the issue is more along the lines of every survivor has the right to choose and the right to determine the correct path of healing that is right for them. For some survivors, it is very important to sort of uncover a lot of those repressed memories. For others, maybe not so much. And I think it's important when we talk, you know, when I train and many of my colleagues work, you know, to do training with other mental health professionals, one of the things that we stress is, you know, there is no single course of treatment that's going to be impactful or successful for every single survivor of trauma and abuse. Every
not one size fits all.
Correct.
Good. Well, you know what I'd like to do? I think this might be a nice, a good opportunity to kind of take a very brief break for another PSA, and then I would love to hear about how you brought your personal experience to male survivors and the plethora of activities that you're doing, the books that you've written, a lot of the events and activities that are going on. Does that sound like a good plan?
Absolutely. Be happy. Yep.
Okay. Delilah, can we have another one? Are you there? Hello?
Well, I'm still here, Donna.
Okay, you're still there. I think she's trying to, maybe her, maybe she has us on mute.
Okay.
Hold on. Sorry, technical difficulties, ladies and gentlemen. This usually doesn't happen.
Yeah, it's fine. It does happen every now and again.
I know, I'm sorry. Hello.
Hi.
You're there. Delilah. Hello.
Hi.
Okay.
If
yeah.
you're wondering, I have been dropped about 3 times now, so I'm here
Uh-oh.
Now.
Oh, dear.
Did you ask me a question?
Yes, I asked you. Could you do the PSA now? We had a nice little segue.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. Thank you.
Is it in play?
He says I am a loser.
Worthless. Unattractive.
Stupid.
Crazy.
Selfish. Broken.
Ungrateful.
Damaged.
Frigid.
Unsupportive.
A bad wife.
A bad mother.
A bad daughter.
Nothing without him.
You don't have to let your partner's voice tell you who you are. If you are being abused, you can get help.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.
And wow. I think that, you know, that's the important message to the PSAs and even the work that Christopher is doing is let the voices be heard. I think
definitely.
Especially men and boys have lived in silence so, so long. And it's not mm-hmm. a topic that's easily discussed, whether, you know, in the media or behind closed doors in a therapy session. It's not an easy subject to talk about. One question I was wondering, Christopher, in the experience that you've had with other survivors, how important is justice to survivors? Do they want to be sure that this perpetrator is charged, or what do you find that the consensus of that is?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really, really great question, Delilah. And I'm very glad you asked me that. I think that there's a very, very big difference between the pursuit of justice and the pursuit of healing. And I think socially, many of us are oriented towards thinking that we need to find justice first before we can allow ourselves the ability to heal. Mm-hmm. And that justice, the experience of receiving justice is in some way a prerequisite for healing. And I try to suggest with the people that I talk with that that's not necessarily the case. There are a tremendous number of survivors, especially of childhood sexual abuse, for whom the way the laws in this country are structured because of statute of limitations in states all over the country, it's very unlikely that a number of people are going to be able to receive justice. For instance, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, and even if I had incontrovertible physical evidence of what was done to me, and I knew, you know, the name of the man that abused me and where he was now, I would not be able to bring him up on charges because of the fact that I'm now 39 years old and the abuse happens.
And the statute of limitations?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this something that organizations are working on to get changed, I believe, right?
Yes, there's a number of organizations that are trying to work mm-hmm. on that around the country. There's a wonderful there's a professor at Cardozo University in New York, a law school in New York, named Marcy Hamilton, who's a good friend of ours and has been working a lot on this. And her website is solreform.com, in case anybody wants to learn more about that effort. But when it comes to the difference between justice and healing, I think it's very, very important for all survivors to recognize that, if you look at or listen to the experiences of any survivors who've gone through the criminal justice process, you will hear over and over again that the effort to bring somebody to justice is oftentimes a challenging, if not re-victimizing and re-traumatizing experience for the victims themselves.
And same thing with homicide survivors, yes.
Absolutely.
I know. Absolutely. Yes, yes. Wow.
And you know, this is not necessarily a criticism of our criminal justice system. But it's important for people to recognize that our criminal justice system is not meant to be a source of healing for mm-hmm. survivors. And I think a lot of people yeah. misunderstand that. Our legal system and the way our laws are structured, we have chosen as a society to not structure them to be necessarily sensitive to the needs of survivors and the realities of survivors. In some mm-hmm. areas, in some ways, that's slowly changing. But I think the important thing to stress, especially around this question, is that for every survivor of trauma and abuse, it's very important to know that the pursuit of justice can be a part of their healing, but it is not an essential prerequisite for healing.
I see. Yeah. That's a very good point. Can you tell what's the real story with respect to underreporting of and the incidence of male sexual assault? And how mm-hmm. widespread is it?
It is extraordinarily underreported. It's very, very difficult to get accurate pictures and actual statistical picture of how prevalent sexual abuse is in general, mm-hmm. and with sexual abuse of males, it's even more difficult for a number of reasons. There's some controversy around the prevalence rates that's sort of going on right now. The statistic that used to be quoted fairly widely was 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys experienced some form of sexual abuse or assault before the age of 16. There's some indication that those numbers are declining, but we don't really have a clear picture yet of how great a decline we are seeing in those statistics. When mm-hmm. it comes to sexual abuse and sexual assault of males, the underreporting in some ways is even more of a challenge for a number of different reasons. First and foremost, males are very, very hesitant to come forward and talk about the experience of being victimized in any way because of the way we socialize masculinity.
How we're acculturated. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, boys and men are told you're not allowed to be a victim. You're not allowed to be vulnerable. And if you come forward and say that, then you are somehow less of a man. Another complicating factor around this is ideas and prejudices around homosexuality. The majority, we don't, and I should also be clear, we don't know how many female perpetrators per se are out there as opposed to male perpetrators of sexual violence, but we know that the numbers of female perpetrators are higher than it is more commonly assumed. There's at least one a set of research that points to approximately 60% male perpetrators versus 40% female perpetrators that male survivors report. But there are a number of males, obviously, who don't want to come forward and disclose that they were sexually abused by a man because they're afraid that they'll be labeled as gay. And it's important for people to understand that the experience of being abused and being harmed or being violated does not define who or what you are. Being abused, sexually abused by a man does not make you gay.
You have a very good list of myths and facts with regard mm-hmm. to, what maybe the general population think. I reviewed those, and I think they're very helpful. So you know, maybe we can incorporate them into our blog, or people go to your website. I mean, just these same kinds of things that you're just talking about. People have the wrong idea. They link it to sexual orientation, you know, all kinds of things. So that certainly is true. You have a wealth of information on your site, Chris. And unfortunately, we only have like 20 minutes left of our show. We need like another hour, I think. You're going to have to come back.
Okay. You know?
But if you'd like, with respect to, I know that you've done a lot of good work. You actually wrote some very innovative things, and I don't know if you would like to briefly talk about those or the book that you've written, the 10 things every partner should know and the 10 things every therapist should know. How did that come about, and are they being utilized by the therapeutic community? And would you like to talk about that?
Sure. Well, boy, there's a whole lot of stuff to talk about around that.
I know.
I don't have enough time to get the books written that I want to write, unfortunately. But there are actually a couple of books that I highly recommend to anybody who wants to know about more about working with male survivors or for male survivors who are looking for resources. And I'll name three of them very quickly. The first is a book by Dr. Howard Fradkin, Fradkin. It's called Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. And that's actually a book that I am a co-author on. It's a book, some of your listeners may remember that Oprah Winfrey did a show with 200 male survivors of sexual abuse in the audience a couple of years ago. Dr. Fradkin was the guest expert on that show, and this is a book that he wrote following those programs, talking about giving information for male survivors and for clinicians who work with male survivors on best practices.
And you were in that audience, right? Or you were part of that?
Yes, I was a part of that group. Yep. They were remarkable programs, and you can still see them online if you go to Oprah's website, or if you do a Google search for Oprah 200 Men. They're really amazing programs. They really are transformative, and we still continue to hear today how they've sort of helped people break their own silence around this issue, which is really a wonderful, wonderful thing.
And isn't there a video here, Back on Track? Is that part of, like, a training video?
The Back on Track video that you see on our website is actually a documentary that comes from Australia that some colleagues of ours released a while back. We use a film called Boys and Men Healing that was released by Big Voice Pictures a few years ago when we do Dare to Dream events around the country.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us about that? I know that you have, I don't know if the right terminology is retreats mm-hmm. or weekends. So that, as well as the event that you just made reference to.
Sure.
Why don't we get into that a bit?
Let me talk about very briefly the resources that Male Survivor provides to survivors and clinicians, and then I'll talk about the events we have coming up in LA in the beginning of November. So MaleSurvivor.org, which is the organization that I joined in 2007 when I was looking for help around this issue of being a male survivor and feeling isolated and alone and not really knowing if there was anybody else who had gone through what I had gone through as a kid. To my surprise and shock, I went online and I found this website, MaleSurvivor.org, and began to read on it all of these articles and this information and join the discussion forums on our website and realize that I'm not alone and that this experience of being sexually abused as a male is actually extraordinarily common. We have hundreds of thousands of people coming to our website every year from all over the world, sharing their stories and breaking their isolation and their silence. And that's a, you know, the website itself is a really, really amazing and powerful tool that really does help a lot of people start their healing journeys. We also
and is the thrust of it to provide education and support? Are those two main purposes?
Yes.
Okay.
And to connect survivors with one another and resources in their communities so that they can find mental health therapists and peer support groups in their communities so that they connect with mm-hmm. so that they can connect with healing resources close to where they are. We have resource directories on the website that help people find therapists and support groups in, you know, where in their communities.
And don't you have a national annual conference?
We do a conference every 2 years. It's actually an international conference. It's the only conference in the world whose sole focus is male sexual victimization. Our next conference will be November of 2014, somewhere in the New York City area. We're actually in the process of trying to locate a venue right now. It's an amazing, amazing experience. And it brings together professionals from all different fields, law enforcement and mental health and social services and other peer advocates, but also survivors themselves. So unlike many professional conferences, you get both the professionals but also the population that the professionals are serving coming together to learn from one another, which is really great.
Yes, that sounds great.
And then we also do our, you know, and the other thing we have, and you referenced before very quickly, you know, is our Weekends of Recovery program. And very quickly, the weekends, we've been doing these for 10 years. We have an amazing team of 16 professional licensed mental health therapists, social workers who developed this program. And it's unique. There's really nothing else like it for any other population of abuse or trauma survivors. They're experiential retreats. We do them 6 times a year in locations all over North America. And over the past 10 years, we've done 50 weekends that have brought together and helped over 1,000 survivors of sexual abuse and their partners come together and heal. And they are truly life transformative experiences. I've been to 3 weekends myself, and if it wasn't for the first weekend I attended in 2007, I don't think it's that far of a stretch to say it's entirely possible that I would not be here today.
Wow. And is this something that they encourage your life partner to join you with, or is it just the people themselves?
Most of the weekends are for male survivors alone. However, every other year we do a weekend retreat for survivors and their partners. And actually, my wife and I'm remarried, and I have an amazing wife today who's extraordinarily supportive and just a wonderful, wonderful person. And actually, we started our honeymoon at a Weekend of Recovery a couple of years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
That reminds me of something. Well, I've just come back from the National Organization for Victim Assistance Conference, and one of our colleagues had mentioned how she and her husband honeymooned there. So it happens more than we think, Chris, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the parallels are really, you know, stunning, and we're coming to a place where we're understanding that the experience of trauma is universal in everybody's life. You know, mm-hmm. abuse happens in all different kinds of ways, but fortunately, the things that we need as human beings to heal from trauma and abuse, I think, are really universal. It requires compassion. It requires support. And being able to access resources and communities of, you know, empathetic, you know, fellow victims or fellow survivors, I think really is a major key to being able to move forward in our lives. So,
do you think we've still got about 11 minutes just to let you know?
Right.
Do you feel as if you're making any headway with regard to getting this? I mean, other than networking with organizations like us, the general public, how are you being received by media? And are you making any headway with that?
At times, yes. At times, no. It's it's a struggle for male survivors, I think, to get to have visibility in the media for a number of different reasons. Recently, the Department of Defense, talking about military sexual trauma, released their statistics for 2012. The number of sexual assaults went up to, I believe they said, 26,000 reported cases of sexual assault within the military. One of the things that was not reported very often was that the actual majority of survivors of military sexual assault or military sexual trauma are men. And when you start to try and talk to people around that, it's very interesting. You don't get a lot of engagement around that picture. Mm-hmm. That said, I think it is getting better for male survivors to find places where they're being heard in the media. And I think part of this is a result of the Jerry Sandusky trial. I like to tell people that we live in a post-Sandusky world, and it's hard to talk about a benefit that's come out of that scandal, but I think one of the things that has been positive has been the fact that, that story in many ways secularized the discussions about sexual abuse of males. It helped people realize that this isn't just something that's happened in the Catholic Church. This is something that is happening in every single community in our country, and that there are survivors in every single faith, in many institutions all over the country, and in really every community. And I think we're starting to get a better understanding and a better appreciation of the fact that this is not this is something that happens everywhere. And the challenge for us as a society is to learn how to do a better job both at prevention and helping parents do a better job of teaching their children how to protect themselves and how to be proactive around these things, but to also be much more, I think, holistic and non-biased and inclusive in providing support to every survivor of abuse and trauma, no matter what their color, what their gender, what their race, what their socioeconomic background is, what their sexual orientation is. It doesn't matter. There's no hierarchy of abuse. There's no, and it doesn't matter who you are. We all go through significant experiences of trauma and or abuse in our lives. And it's only when we come together to support one another that we as victims are able to move forward into becoming survivors. And I think as we do that, we actually have more effective responses and reduce the incidence of violence and trauma and abuse all around us.
Makes sense to me. Another question: how prevalent and with the people that you've worked with is abuse between siblings? And is that harder for a healing to occur when it's between people within their own family?
It's not uncommon at all. I don't have handy research or statistics that I can quote to you off the top of my head, but again, it's when we're talking about sexual abuse of males, the research is somewhat spotty, in general. That said, I have spoken to a number of survivors who were victimized by brothers or sisters or, other family members, oftentimes mothers and fathers. And it can be very, very difficult when the harm of abuse is sort of compiled. The harm of sexual abuse is sort of compounded with the fact that this is somebody who is, your kin, and oftentimes is somebody who is still a part of your life. It's an extraordinarily difficult challenge for many families to try and come to grips with.
Yeah, and since you have an international focus too, is there any particular geographic area where it's more rampant in comparison to the U.S. or this is just something that, you know, no one is addressing?
I will tell you, it's interesting. When you look at the statistics for website traffic to MailSurvivor.org, the majority of the traffic comes from the United States and Canada. The second country that drives the most traffic to our website is
Hello? Are you there?
We've lost Chris. Hopefully he'll call back in. We just have a few minutes left, but I don't know.
Yeah.
We've had quite the you must have the best connection of all, Donna, thank goodness, because my call
I don't know what happened
three
today.
Times.
Everyone's like dropping out. Yeah, and I just have this little unsophisticated flip phone.
I don't think it's the phone.
I upgrade. Yeah. It's just a connection.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
Is he here?
Chris,
I'm
are
back.
You back? Here you
yep,
are.
I don't
did you
know
drop
what happened.
Out of cyberspace?
I got dropped off. I got dropped off.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So I think you were telling us we've got like 4 minutes. I'm still trying to be the timekeeper here. What country gives you the most traffic besides the U.S. and Canada?
The U.S. and Canada, besides the U.S., actually the second country that drives the most traffic to our website is India, interestingly enough. And when you actually look, and when you look at the statistics really around the world, it's extraordinary. And we have traffic coming to our website from every country on the face of the planet. I don't, and personally, I tend to feel that I don't know that there's any country or any region or, where sexual abuse is more prevalent than others. I think at a baseline, it happens far more often than people are very comfortable confronting or recognizing or acknowledging. But I will say my gut and some of the information and research that I've read leads me to believe that in countries where there are more, higher levels of socioeconomic instability, higher levels of poverty, higher levels of powerlessness and hopelessness.
It's going to be more prolific.
More prolific, absolutely.
Yeah, that totally makes sense, I know. Well, what would you want to say with regard to this episode of a parting message for our audience to leave us with? And we'll certainly put in all the informational links for them too. We didn't get to talk about everything.
Well, you're never able to talk about everything, and the conversation and the work of healing from all forms of trauma and abuse, I believe is the work of a lifetime. And I think it's really important as a sort of a final message for every survivor to know that healing is possible. We talk about the elements of recovery from abuse and trauma, and we think there are three key elements, hope, healing, and support. We need to have all three of those things in order to be able to really make a lot of progress on the journey of recovery. And when we talk about hope specifically, we refer to three key messages of hope. And I think these are probably the best way to end is to leave with these messages. And for every survivor to know that you are not alone, it was not your fault, and that it is possible to heal.
Wow. Yeah, that is possible. That's very powerful. And Delilah, do we possibly have, I think we have about a minute and a half. Chris, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Please keep in touch with me. Maybe we can have you back soon because we just scratched the surface. Okay, and do we have enough time to do one more PSA spot?
Oh, yeah, we'll close out with a PSA once you're finished.
Okay.
I'll say the music will close out with a PSA. But, we need to give the website for the listeners to Male Survivor.
It's MaleSurvivor.org. And if anybody has any questions or they can follow up with me, my email address is canderson@MaleSurvivor.org.
C. Anderson at
That's great. It's great to be
okay,
so available.
Good. Yes, thank you for being available, because there are a lot of people out there that are hearing this information for the first time. And please do keep in mind, please do go to www.donnagore.com to see all the information that keeps us busy and helps us working with victims of crime, as well as Lila's website. Shattered Lives, stay tuned for another show next Saturday. Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you, Delilah. We'll talk to you off air. And everyone, have a good evening.
And everyone, remember the survivors of domestic violence, there's so many that aren't surviving. So we need to do our part.
They seem like such a perfect couple. There must be some other explanation.
Why doesn't she just leave?
I don't understand why she puts up with him.
It takes two to argue.
It's not my place to interfere.
If someone you know is a victim of intimate partner abuse, you can give them back their voice.
Call 1-800-799-SAFE or go to thehotline.org.
Let your voice be heard.